From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Bob Oakes, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. All eyes may be on Ukraine this morning, but the Ukrainian people themselves and what they may want are almost an afterthought right now. The big story today is the big game between Russia and the West. What that game actually is and how we got where we are today, well, there's still a lot of room for debate on that. This hour, On Point, figuring out the stakes in Ukraine. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Are you watching the headlines? Which way do you think this will go? A nasty war across Ukraine? A new Cold War? What do you think the U.S. and Europe should do next? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining us now to talk about what's going on, at least diplomatically this morning, from New York is Colm Lynch, senior reporter for Foreign Policy Magazine, covering the UN and international diplomacy. Colm, good morning, and thanks for speaking with us.
Not at all. Thanks for having me, Bob.
Colm, Secretary of State John Kerry will be in Kiev tomorrow to meet with the Ukrainian government officials. What's his most immediate mission?
Well, I mean, the most immediate mission is to get the Russians to start talking to the Ukrainian government and to try to resolve this sort of this whole situation sort of diplomatically, and also to show that the United States is you know, behind the new government in Ukraine. I mean, essentially over the last 24 hours, Kerry has been warning the Russians that this will lead to sort of further diplomatic isolation and some sort of commercial cost, potentially economic sanctions against individuals closely associated with the government in Moscow. And so I think it's, you know, mostly to show that the United States is in this game, and actions that Russia takes will, you know, deeply affect its relationship with the U.S. and the West.
Well, what do you think the Ukrainians are going to want from John Kerry?
Well, the Ukrainians want, I mean, they would like a lot of things. They will want, you know, financial, economic support. They want political support. And I'm sure that they would like to have some sort of form of military support. I don't think anybody is arguing that the Ukrainian government is really in a position to, you know, to fundamentally kind of withstand a Russian sort of military, you know, challenge. But they have, you know, been, you know, mobilizing reserves. They have been initially talking about some sort of willingness to defend themselves. And if they do find themselves in that position, they would want to have support from the outside, from the Europeans and the U.S.
Well, Secretary of State Kerry at this point is offering support in the way of words. Yesterday on NBC's Meet the Press, he said that the Russian invasion in Crimea will have consequences for Putin and Russia. Let's listen.
He's going to lose on the international stage. Russia is going to lose. The Russian people are going to lose. He's going to lose all of the glow that came out of the Olympics, his $60 billion extravaganza. He is not going to have a Sochi G8. He may not even remain in the G8 if this continues. He may find himself with asset freezes on Russian business. American business may pull back. There may be a further tumble of the ruble. There's a huge price to pay.
Among the other statements that Secretary Kerry has made in the last day or day and a half, he called it a brazen act of aggression, violating many international agreements. I'm wondering, Colm, though, what's the toughest thing you think that John Kerry has said?
Well, I mean, you know, if, you know, American businesses sort of follow suit and take away from Kerry's remarks that there is going to be a cost for doing business in American sort of financial markets and business start to lessen their financial kind of relations with Russia, that would have a big impact. It wouldn't have probably as big an impact as, you know, if the Europeans join and impose tough sanctions on the Russians. But there's a real question mark as to whether that's going to happen, particularly Germany, which I think has been a bit cool to the idea of throwing the Russians out of the G8. They have far deeper economic commercial contacts with Russia. I think Russia is like the Germany is Russia's largest trading partner. The Germans export a lot to Russia, a lot of goods, not as much as they do to China or the U.S., but I think, you know, they come shortly, you know, right after that. So I think the real question is how far are the Europeans going to go in their meeting today in Brussels to discuss this issue? And I would frankly be surprised if they came out with the same kind of measures that, that Kerry has been suggesting. So there's a lot that can be done. You know, there's an interesting also development on this whole question of sanctioning individuals who are sort of, you know, aligned with a government that is misbehaving. And one of the interesting things that in what you're seeing over the last couple of months is that in Europe, the major courts in Europe are challenging these kind of sort of punitive sanctions against individuals and asset freezes. So there's kind of a broader kind of push back on economic sanctions on Europe, and that's going to be a fundamental kind of battleground for the Americans' ability to make these kinds of measures, you know, sort of really bite.
Well, how much of this do you think is just going to roll off President Putin's back? As anyone in the U.S., and there's been a lot of talk here, and has anyone in Europe said anything yet that's actually gotten his attention?
Well, I mean, they have all, you know, I mean, most of the Europeans have been, you know, declaring that Russia is in violation of international law. You know, a lot of them were saying the same thing about the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003. But, you know, whether this is a fundamental turning point and will sort of mark, you know, a move away from Russia by the Europeans and the Americans, or whether they sort of just, you know, eventually come to terms with this, I mean, it's, you know, anybody's guess. So it's hard to say.
Will, the last question, do you think the threat of sanctions, the threat of possibly throwing Russia out of the G8, will be enough to keep Putin from diving further into Ukraine and maybe eastern Ukraine with troops?
Absolutely not. I mean, I think that, you know, Putin has shown that he's determined to sort of move as far militarily as he needs to. I mean, he's already been sending troops into the Crimea. And, you know, I'm sure that if, you know, if Ukrainian forces engage Russian troops in Crimea, that the government, you know, would, that Russia might use that as a pretext for kind of expanding its presence. So I think one of the things that probably Kerry and the UN and others are trying to convince the Ukrainians is don't provoke the Russians. Don't do anything that would give them a pretext to sort of go beyond where they have already gone.
All right. Colm Lynch, thank you very much for joining us. Colm, joining us from New York, senior reporter for Foreign Policy Magazine. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Bob.
Going to go right to the Crimea now, as joining us from Simferopol is Sabra Ayers, correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. Sabra, welcome back to On Point. Appreciate it. Sabra Ayers, can you hear us?
I'm here.
Thank you so very much. We've got you now. Tell us the latest on what the Russians are doing today. What are the Russian troops actually holding right now?
Well, at this point, they've surrounded a couple of Ukrainian military bases, and presumably they're trying to get the Ukrainian soldiers who are in there to give up and come to their side. So far, the Ukrainians have said, forget it, no way, we're standing, you know, in our bases. So there's a bit of a standoff. So far, it's been, I don't know if we'd say peaceful, but there's been no shots fired in that sense. But it's quite tense around those bases. And, you know, the rest of Crimea, I mean, it's kind of people are going about their day in the cities. I'm in Simferopol and people are going about their day. There's not massive protests here or anything. But at those bases, it's like a standoff.
Russian news agencies report that some of the Ukrainian armed forces who were dispatched to the region switched the side of the Russian sympathizers, and that they may actually take the military oath. It's also been reported there may have been mass resignations among the members of the Ukrainian military. Have you seen any signs of that?
No. They had one guy. This is, you know, the biggest problem with this whole situation is it's like an information war. The Russian media is coming out with all kinds of outlandish things. And this has been part of the problem, especially here in Crimea and in the eastern part of Ukraine, is that the Ukrainians who are picking up that Russian news are seeing images of what they're calling fascist Western Ukrainians. And that's putting, you know, that's scaring them. And this has been driving a lot of this situation down here. There was a Ukrainian
naval officer who did switch sides. He's now being charged with treason in Ukraine. But as far as other Ukrainian soldiers, no, they're not. From what I've seen and the reports I've seen, they are not switching sides. They're doing their best to hold their own.
Does it appear, from what you've been able to see, as if Russian troops may, in fact, be poised to move further into eastern Ukraine?
Well, there have been reports that they've seen Russian troops down in the southeast of the Crimean Peninsula in a town called Kerch, which is about, you know, a dozen miles from across a strait. There's a strait that separates Kerch and the Russian land. So there have been reports of troops that are amassed there. In terms of, there's been a lot of rumors, but at this point, the Putin's call for troops to come into Ukraine is a bit odd, because there have been troops here all along. They don't have they don't have Russian flags on their shoulders. They're not carrying Russian, you know, any sort of like indication, except that the vehicles are in. So it's this massively confusing situation where the Kremlin is saying we've gotten our government to our parliament to approve troops coming, but the troops are already here, but not in the massive amount that everyone's fearing at this point.
Saber Ayers, thank you very much for joining us right now. Correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, joining us from Simferopol in Ukraine's Crimea. I'm Bob Oakes in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Bob Oakes. In for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this morning about Ukraine and Crimea. On Sunday, as you're hearing in the background, there were fierce clashes in the city of Kharkiv between pro and anti-government protesters. No gunfire so far as we know, between Russian troops that have gone into Crimea and the Ukrainian forces still there. As the Ukraine and Crimea and the U.S. and the West try to make sense of what's really going on. Joining us now from Washington is Angela Stent, director of the Center for Eurasian, Russian, and Eastern European Studies at Georgetown University, former intelligence officer at the National Intelligence Council, and author of The Limits of Partnership, U.S.-Russian Relations in the 21st Century. Angela, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And from New York, we're joined by Stephen Cohen, Professor Emeritus of Russian Studies and Politics at New York University, a contributor to The Nation. His most recent book, just out in paperback, is Soviet Fates and Lost Alternatives, From Stalinism to the New Cold War. Stephen, good to have you.
Thank you.
So the big question right now is what happens next? Russia seems de facto to have taken over Crimea, at least at this moment. Do you think the U.S. can live with that? And Angela, let's start with you.
Well, I think the real immediate problem now is to make sure that this doesn't spread and that there isn't a civil war and this doesn't spread to the eastern regions of Ukraine that you were just talking about. But I think, in fact, probably we will live with the fact that Russia has occupied Crimea. It does have a naval base there. This is an area that was historically part of Russia. And probably it'll be a situation, a kind of a gray zone, where they'll have their autonomous government linked to Russia. They won't really be under the control of Kiev, but they're not going to be an independent state, rather like several other situations like that in the post-Soviet space, these kind of quasi-state entities. And I think we will have to live with it, because I think we have to accept these facts on the ground.
Stephen, your take on this?
Well, I agree with Angela. I'd frame it a little differently. I don't know if Angela would agree. We're witnessing history in the making of the worst kind. What has happened is the descent of a new Cold War divide in Europe, between West and East, but this time not in faraway Berlin, but right on Russia's borders in Ukraine, through the heart of Slavic civilization. If this new Cold War divide stands, and I think Angela is absolutely right, one way or another, Crimea will now be under Russian authority, however they structure that. Home rule, more autonomy, affiliated with Russia, affiliated with Ukraine. That is, I think, a settled issue now. If this divide, it's not an iron curtain, I haven't thought of the word of what kind of curtain it is, but if this new divide stands, I ask you to consider how dangerous it will be, not today or tomorrow, but for our children and our grandchildren. It will be a permanent source of confrontation between West and East, fraught with the possibility of instability and even hot war of the worst kind. In the next few days, it may play out even worse. I don't think it will, but let's keep in mind what could happen if there are provocations or unwise leadership in Washington or Moscow. That would be that the West, the EU and Washington, would decide to move NATO troops, if not into Western Ukraine, to the Polish-Ukrainian border. There are calls for that in Europe and in Washington now. If that happens, Putin will almost certainly send troops from Russia, because I'm not sure those troops that have taken control of Crimea have actually crossed the border in from Russia into Ukraine. They may be troops that were stationed at the naval base. I just don't know. Nobody's given us a fix on that. But if NATO were to move to the western border of Ukraine, Putin would probably move more troops from Russia into Ukraine and probably further into eastern and southern Ukraine. And then the situation would be triply worse.
Well,
where we stand now.
What's the likelihood of that, Stephen? You've set out the possibility. What's the likelihood from your point of view?
You know, I don't think, and I'd like to hear Angela's opinion on this, because she knows Moscow as well as I do, certainly. Maybe she knows it better, but I feel I know Moscow. We need to see this, because this is the only way we can make policy, through the eyes of Moscow, the Kremlin, and Putin. Putin is under tremendous pressure. He feels, and I think in this case, he's been provoked, that we triggered this crisis in Ukraine, not Russia. He's being told in Moscow by guys more anti-Western than he is that the fate of Russia is now in his hands, that if Ukraine, and particularly Crimea, is lost, he will go down in Russian history in infamy as one of the most despised Russian leaders ever. In addition, as you know from your reports, there are clamorous pro-Russian, some of it provoked, but a lot of it real, clamorous pro-Russian calls in Ukraine for Russian intervention. Many Ukrainians of Russian descent are afraid of this government in Kiev, which has already passed a law banning the use of Russian as an official language. So we need to bear in mind the pressure that Putin is under. And I don't think that the statements by Secretary of State Kerry help the situation. The reality is, to be harsh about this, that Kerry's foreign policy is in shambles. From Syria and Iran and the Middle East to Russia, everything they've tried to do in the last 3 or 4 months is now in shambles. They need to talk seriously with Putin. Now, we know Obama and Putin had a 90-minute phone call. We were told what Obama said. We don't know what Putin told him, but I think Putin told him just what I told you.
All right, Stephen Cohen, you've given us a lot to digest there. Angela Stent, help us out. What do you think President Putin wants out of this?
Well, first of all, I want to go back to the question of what triggered the crisis. And there you have to go back, you know, 22 years, Ukraine has been an independent state, but in those 22 years, it has failed to build kind of effective state and governing institutions. It's had various governments that have been more or less corrupt, but haven't established really a very well-functioning state. And then secondly, it's been unable to establish an agreement on national identity. And you've heard that from all of your previous speakers. There is a sharp division between the western part of Ukraine that looks to the west and the eastern part of Ukraine, much of which looks to Russia. And because of this weakness and because of the corrupt state, you got to the situation where the population went out into the streets after the European Union had been negotiating an agreement with the former President Yanukovych. Nobody's offering Ukraine membership of the EU. They never have. But this was supposed to help them clean up the government, have a free trade agreement, et cetera, et cetera. And because he then reneged on that, because Russia put pressure on him and offered also carrots, offered money, he reneged on that. Then the people came out in the streets. So the origins of this crisis are the weakness and the problems in Ukraine itself. And this has been an issue, as I say, for the last 22 years. The U.S. has sometimes been more and sometimes less present in dealing with this. And really, since the former president was elected in 2010, the U.S. wasn't that focused on Ukraine. We had a reset in the first Obama term, and that really involved paying more attention to Russia and less attention to Russia's neighbors, particularly Ukraine. And so this is how we got into this situation. And now, you know, we don't have that many levers. We came late to this, the U.S. did. You know, we showed up in November when people were already in the square, were demonstrating December. You know, there are all the financial sanctions that people have offered. But we, you know, we cannot not take a stand. I mean, there are domestic interests in Russia, which Steve Cohen has talked about, which Putin is listening to. There are, of course, domestic constituencies in the U.S. We have a Congress that really wants to take very strong action. You have the NATO countries trying to figure out how they can respond and sort of scrambling. And so they're now talking about, you know, possible exercises, maneuvers. There's a lot of stuff that's out there that's being proposed. And then we also have the piece of information from Chancellor Merkel, apparently during her call, that Mr. Putin doesn't seem to quite understand the realities of all of this. So I suspect, and I think Steve Cohen is right, that people are telling him that this is, you know, the last stand in a way, and that he really believes that quote-unquote fascists and terrorists, you know, have taken control in Kiev and are trying to impose their will on eastern Ukraine. It's much more complicated than that. But I think the immediate task will still be, and this is where the Europeans are coming in and doing more, to try and engage Russia in a conversation, I guess send a fact-finding mission, establish a contact group like we had in the former Yugoslavia, where Russia and the major European countries and the U.S. are included, something to diffuse this. And I think that's going to be the most likely reaction in the next few days.
Do you think that this has a Cold War field? And do you think Putin wants exactly that, for the world to see Russia as still a tough Cold War bear?
Well, it certainly does have a Cold War feel. I mean, we always say, we reiterate all the time, the Cold War is over, but this looks and feels like the Cold War, except we don't have our nuclear weapons pointed at each other, and, you know, we're not in a global ideological struggle. But I think he, you know, for Vladimir Putin, who has said that the collapse of the Soviet Union was the greatest geopolitical catastrophe of the 20th century, making sure that Russia still has its own privileged sphere of influence and in its relations with the post-Soviet states. He has said on numerous occasions, including to President George W. Bush in 2008, that Ukraine isn't a country, that, you know, it's two parts of Ukraine cobbled together that don't have much coherence. And I think for him, making sure that, you know, that Russia maintains its role as a great power also includes maintaining its special ties with Ukraine. And so for him, the idea that NATO or the European Union would encroach on Ukraine, I mean, the NATO question is off the table. The European Union, as I say, is only offering a weak form of an association. But the idea that those, that either of those organizations would establish a foothold in Ukraine, and that Ukraine really would move away from its close ties to Russia, that is something that is the bottom line for him. And I think that that is the most important foreign policy goal for him at the moment.
So at least part of this, as Stephen Cohen said a minute ago, is this is Russia pushing back as the U.S., Europe and NATO push east.
Yes, I mean, the U.S. hasn't been pushing east that much, but the European Union has. But let me just say, the European Union itself is divided over this. The Poles, the Baltic states, they've been pushing this with the Swedes, the move east to Ukraine. The Germans, the French, Italians, they're much more reluctant, which is why I don't think you're going to see a very tough sanctions response, certainly from the Europeans.
Stephen Cohen, let me ask you, do you think that Vladimir Putin is trying to reestablish the old Soviet ways and territories, or just the spirit in the bigger picture?
No, I don't think he's trying to reestablish the Soviet Union. Putin once said something witty but profound. And actually, he didn't originate it, but he's repeated it several times. He said as follows, anyone who does not regret the end of the Soviet Union does not have a heart. Anyone who thinks it can be reconstituted doesn't have a brain. Sentimentality for the Soviet Union runs wide and deep in Russia. But look, I agree with Angela, but I think she's omitted the prehistory. And yet she's written a very good book on the subject. And I've written a book, Soviet Fates, which the concluding two chapters deal with that same period, but we have somewhat different perspectives. What has the Kremlin before Putin and under Putin seen from the West? It's seeing the steady march of the West, led by the United States, toward post-Soviet Russia since the 1990s. The driving force of that has been the expansion of NATO eastward, and it is now from Germany, and it is now on Russia's borders in the Baltics. And if you consider Belarus as essentially a part of Russia, it's also in Poland. That's the big picture. And it's not only the expansion of NATO, but missile defense, these installations that we want to build in Central and Eastern Europe and are building, they're a NATO project. So Russia sees this still coming at them. Now let's go back to what Angela said, because I think she omitted something. Maybe she forgot it. In November, when the crisis began, when, the elected president, he was elected constitutionally, he was a rotter, but he was elected, decided against signing the EU so-called Economic Civilizational Partnership. I'm not sure if anybody read that document, because that 1,000-page document that Ukraine was asked to sign includes military obligations. And I think if anybody reads them, they say that in signing those documents, Ukraine would have been obliged to adhere to NATO policy, whatever it might be. So it is not quite accurate to say that there was no NATO component in the agreement that Ukraine rejected. One other point, and Angela made this point, don't speak about Ukraine and the Ukrainians. There are probably four or five. Nobody talks about Central Ukraine, which is a melting pot of so many ethnicities, I can't count them. But for analysis' sake, there are at least two Ukraines, one in the east and the south, with an affinity for Russia, one in the west that was never part of the Russian Empire, with an affinity, and Angela is absolutely right, for Poland, Lithuania, and Sweden, who have been driving this whole thing. We're dealing with an artificial state. And maybe in the end, partition is inevitable and the best solution. But here's the question for today, and we need to discuss this. Putin is saying that the government in Kiev today, which we call the Ukrainian government, is illegitimate. It is not a legitimate government. And if you were to put on your broadcast a half a dozen constitutional and international lawyers, I think they would agree, because what happened was the constitutional order of Ukraine and the constitutionally elected president was overthrown. The parliament that is now passing laws is a rump parliament. The majority parties, the party of the regions, which was the party of Yanukovych, the president who's fled to Russia, and the Ukrainian Communist Party, had a majority in that party.
I have to ask, do you see Yanukovych coming back to Ukraine?
No. I mean, he has no credibility in Ukraine. Putin despises him. He thinks he's a coward, thinks he's corrupt. But as they say in America, you can't beat a horse without a horse. So they brought him to Russia. They've let him speak on national television to say that he is the legitimate president of Ukraine. And in constitutional international law terms, that is true. He signed an agreement with the EU about 2 weeks ago for a way out. That's what the European Union foreign ministers told us. Early elections.
Stephen Cohen. Stephen Cohen, got to take a break. We're discussing the unfolding story in Ukraine. I'm Bob Oakes, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking today at the events in Ukraine. Very unnerving. This could settle down to a new status quo within a matter of days, or things could get uglier fast. President Obama spoke out on Friday against Russia and President Putin's military intervention in Ukraine, warning there could be consequences.
Just days after the world came to Russia for the Olympic Games, it would invite the condemnation of nations around the world. And indeed, the United States will stand with the international community in affirming that there will be costs for any military intervention in Ukraine.
Not exactly universal praise for the president's stance on Ukraine here at home. Yesterday, Republican Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina appeared on CNN's State of the Union with Candy Crowley and criticized the president for his handling of Ukraine.
We have a weak and indecisive president that invites aggression. President Obama needs to do something. How about this? Suspend Russian membership in the G8 and the G20 at least for a year, starting right now. And for every day they stay in the Crimea, add to the suspension. Do something.
Our guests are Angela Stent, director of the Center for Eurasian Russian and East European Studies at Georgetown University, former intelligence officer at the National Intelligence Council, and Stephen Cohen, professor emeritus at New York University and contributing editor to The Nation. Let me ask you, the administration has been warning Putin against moving on Ukraine, and yet Putin clearly ignored it. We heard the president a moment ago warning Russia on this, yet Russia moves within hours. Is President Obama weakened by this, Angela Stent?
Well, I think we first of all have to understand that for Russia, Ukraine is an immediate overriding interest. For the United States, Ukraine is an interest for us, but we have plenty of other things, and you've mentioned all of them, that we have to be concerned about. The second point is, and I show this in my book, The Limits of Partnership, we have always had a compartmented relationship with Russia. That is to say, while things can be quite bad and while we can disagree on some issues, we have to work together on a range of multilateral issues. And right now, Iran, very important. We want to achieve an agreement with Iran. Russia is a key player here, and you know that's very much in our minds. Syria, we've had disagreements with Russia clearly about what should happen in terms of the civil war and whether Assad should remain or go, but we have been working with Russia when they took the initiative to disarm Syria of its chemical weapons. The greater Middle East, post-2014 Afghanistan, these are all areas where we must work with Russia and where we can work with Russia, and therefore, when we think about Ukraine, that's obviously the immediate concern, and we don't want a civil war there, but we have other equities, we have other things that we have to be concerned about. And again, this is a top priority for Russia. It hasn't until now been a top priority for the United States.
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head in one way. Is the situation with Ukraine complicated by what happened with Syria last year when Syria was viewed as having crossed President Obama's red line in terms of the use of chemical weapons there, and yet there was little or no consequence coming out of the White House? So is Russia even worried about what President Obama has to say about Ukraine?
Well, I mean, I think, again, you know, we've seen one case where President Obama drew a red line and then somehow it wasn't a red line. And therefore, I'm sure that what went into President Putin's calculations was, yes, the West would complain, they'd be upset about this, but whatever reaction the West can have, you know, pales in comparison to the importance for Russia of having this foothold in Crimea, making sure that Ukraine doesn't move to the West, and protecting Russia's, you know, naval base there and its equities there. And therefore, you know, and the other thing you can say is we don't have much of a relationship with Russia. You know, the reset is over. The granting of political asylum to Edward Snowden clearly sort of was the end of that reset. We don't have much trade with Russia. It's less than 2% of our trade. And therefore, we don't have much economic leverage. And from Putin's point of view, you know, these other things took precedence.
All right, let's take a couple of calls. Fairhan is on the line from Pembroke Pines, Florida. Hi, Fairhan.
Hi, Bob. Thank you very much for the opportunity. I would also like to thank your speakers for sharing their time with us, especially Mr. Cohen. Your analysis was quite insightful, and I commend you for it. I just wanted to start with initially saying that or noting that it's somewhat hypocritical for Russia to sort of invade the sovereignty of Ukraine, given Vladimir Putin's outspoken comment in the New York Times and their stance in regards to Syria. But more importantly, as far as our response the United States of America, I believe that instead of selective sort of economic sanctions, we should embark on unilateral sanctions because I think the selective sanctions wouldn't be as effective. And additionally, the unilateral sanctions should be swift and preferably bypass the UN bureaucracy because, I mean, at the rate at which this situation is moving, is any indication, there needs to be a swift action now.
And the sanctions should include what, Farhan, from your point of view? What's the top actions?
Thank you. The sanctions should include, trade involving Russia as well as Russian economic interests in the United States. I'm speaking for what we as the United States of America should do. I mean, of course, the European Union has a lot more at stake given their higher trade volume and closer interests. So I guess what I'm trying to say is in order to compensate for their inability to, make a strong stance, we should do everything in our power, which I think we can do a lot.
All right, let's get Stephen Cohen to weigh in on this. Stephen Cohen, sanctions, should there be unilateral sanctions from the U.S. Imposed on Russia for this? And what's the likelihood or not of that?
Oh, I think Congress will force Obama to do some token sanctions, but I think Angela already went to that point. We don't have enough of a trade relationship with Russia for those to mean anything. I mean, both Angela and I agree that the stakes for Putin and Russia are so high that a few billion dollars here and there aren't going to sway the issue. And if you bring sanctions against Russian assets in the United States, for example, what are you going to do? Confiscate the Brooklyn Nets, which are owned by a Russian oligarch, Mikhail Prokhorov? This is actually the weakest of sidebars. But let's go back to Syria, which everybody's mentioned. People are saying, the Republicans are saying, that Obama showed weakness in Syria and Putin saw weakness, and therefore he moved on Ukraine. That's fundamentally nonsense. Let's remember what happened in August. Obama's presidency was on the abyss. He had said he would attack Syria over the chemical weapons. Then he decided he didn't want to. He went to Congress, and he discovered that not even his own party in Congress would give him a resolution to attack Syria. And it looked like it was the end of his presidency. And what happened? Putin saved his presidency. He compelled his client, Assad, in Syria to destroy Syria's chemical weapons, which, so far as I know, is underway. That was an enormous gift, or not gift, but an enormous act of cooperation by Putin to Obama. And in addition, as Angela pointed out, Russia's been instrumental in bringing Iran to the negotiating table. That's what's at stake here. What did we do in return? And here, I guess I disagree with Angela. In November of last year, when the protesters went onto the streets, because Yanukovych, the Ukrainian president, didn't sign the European agreement, Putin said something fundamentally positive, I thought. He said, why impose an either-or situation on Ukraine? We, Russia, are prepared with the European Union to do a kind of mini Marshall Plan financially to help Ukraine. They don't have to decide between us and Europe, and let things sort down, and later we'll decide which economic union, if either, Ukraine will join. And that was rejected. And the rejection of that, the ultimatum that the EU posed to Ukraine, precipitated this crisis. That why did we take an either-or position on this economic agreement? And I think in Putin's mind, the reason is that the West is marching on Ukraine. They thought this was the chance to take the brass ring, Russia's most valuable national security asset, Crimea in particular, but Ukraine in general. That's how we got here.
All right, let's have Angela weigh in on that point, and then we'll go right back to the phones. Angela.
Well, I don't quite see it that way. I mean, you know, I heard President Putin, I guess, in September when people were discussing this. This was at a conference in Moscow about whether it was possible for a country to be both in, you know, to have an association agreement with the European Union and to be in this Eurasian Union that President Putin is trying to create, an economic union of as many of the post-Soviet states as possible. I think that the answer was it wasn't. So I think Ukraine was certainly presented with an either-or choice, that it was impossible to have both. But a lot of that was also coming from Russia. So that was certainly how it was portrayed to them.
All right. Olga is on the line from Newton, Massachusetts. Hi, Olga.
Hi, Bob. I live in America, but I'm from Eastern Ukraine, and that's the region that speaks Russian and is considered pro-Russian. I'm basically, thank you for your program. I am impacted, and I think we all impacted. I do want to talk about the information war that I think is going on also in Ukraine and in Russia now, the propaganda that Putin is very cleverly using, and also the focus is on Crimea these days, but there are very disturbing news from the eastern parts of Ukraine. I'm monitoring the situation. I used to be a journalist there. It's very disturbing because there are a lot of sort of like civil Russian tourists, so-called, that are crossing borders and coming into towns and trying to provoke some street confrontations. And a lot of people in Ukraine understand that and trying to stay calm and not be provoked. But it's very clear that Putin is trying to create those cases to investigate later. And also, one more point, I do think that the violation of the Budapest Treaty that let Ukraine to give up their nuclear arsenals in 1994 is pretty dangerous, and not, you know, just to stand by and issue empty threats is not enough, because it's sending a very dangerous message to countries that are trying to give up their nuclear programs.
Olga, thank you very much. Let me ask our guests, Angela Stanton, Stephen Cohen. Angela, I'll start with you. Do you think Russia makes a move on eastern Ukraine as well?
It could. I mean, this is the main question that's preoccupying everyone now. What are President Putin's future intentions? I just want to underscore what the last caller said. 20 years ago, Russia, the United States, Ukraine, and Britain signed an agreement whereby Ukraine gave up its nuclear weapons. It was at that point the third largest nuclear country in the world. And in return for that, it was guaranteed a recognition of its territorial integrity and its sovereignty. And that agreement has clearly been violated now. I think Putin is maybe waiting to see. I think we've seen some evidence. I think we also have to understand that there's some groups and people in eastern Ukraine that are just acting independently, autonomously, and that's the most dangerous thing, not under the control of anyone or not being, you know, told what to do by anyone. But you've had fights breaking out between different groups that are pro and anti-Russian, and it's that kind of thing where one has to be concerned that Russia will then use this as a pretext, you know, protecting their fellow Russians, protecting people who want to be able to speak the Russian language, being called in to offer humanitarian assistance. I mean, these phrases are used a lot, and that's the thing one has to be very concerned about, and that's what I'm sure Kerry and all of the other intermediaries are trying to make sure that Russia is not given a pretext because of events on the ground that are very hard to control, a pretext to then go in and spread, that its forces will then be active in other parts of eastern Ukraine and will kind of
spread
this occupation.
All right. A couple of minutes left, Stephen Cohen. Just a couple of minutes left. Stephen Cohen, will Russia and President Putin move further? Will he move troops into eastern Ukraine?
You asked at the top of your show, your first guest, what he thought Kerry was going to say in Kiev when he goes tomorrow. I hope he's going to tell this so-called government in Kiev, which lacks still constitutional international legitimacy, to chill out. because this government is strongly influenced, and we haven't mentioned this yet, by an extreme right-wing, I would call it quasi-fascist movement in Ukraine. It's represented in the so-called Svoboda or Freedom Party in the Ukraine and in the streets by something called the Right Sector. I agree they're not a large part of Ukrainian politics, but they're organized, they're determined, they're well-funded, they're armed, and they are the tail that's wagging the dog of Kiev. And let me tell you what they want. They don't want anything to do with Europe either. They consider Europe to be decadent, to be run by Jews, gays.
We only have a minute left, Stephen Cohen, and I want to get your answer to the question, does Putin move in eastern Ukraine?
The forces in eastern Ukraine that are doing provocations are equally matched by the forces in western Ukraine that are doing provocations. And herein lies the danger. It's not just the areas that are pro-Russian. It's the areas that are pro-Western. And Angela was right. We're in a situation where nobody controls anybody.
Stephen,
who's trying to control something.
Stephen Cohen, thank you very much. Appreciate your conversation today on Point. Stephen Cohen, Professor Emeritus of Russian Studies and Politics at New York University. Thanks to Angela Stent, Director of the Center for Eurasian, Russian, and Eastern European Studies at Georgetown University. Continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Bob Oakes, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.